Well, last time we kind of got started in Romans 6, sort of, because jumping right into the middle of a book like that and then asking questions like, well, what should we conclude then? Which means we have to go back and talk about the then things. And so in that initial study, we raised the question of why Paul would even ask the question in verse 1 of chapter 6 about continuing in sin. Almost every believer automatically knows that is not an option unless they're thoroughly mixed up. And some new believers are thoroughly mixed up, and they might go there. But in order to try to answer the question why the question was even raised, we backtracked into a few verses in chapter 5 and found at least four issues that might lead a person to think that how we act in time is really of no consequence. I mean, if grace is going to abound or superabound where sin abounds, there are at least four things that might make a person think, well, if grace is going to superabound, then I don't have to worry about it. The first thing we noticed was in chapter 5, verse 19, because it posits the actual production of persons who do what they do by reason of how they were put together the way they were. Adam actually constituted his race sinners. Therefore, they can only sin. And then Paul used exactly the same verb and says that Christ constituted those who believe in him as righteous. And therefore, the implication would be they can only do righteousness. But all of us know that if that's true, then none of us are believers, or there's something else that we have to deal with. And we're all going to assume that it's something else, not the fact that we don't believe the truth. So we looked at the text and saw that Paul used the future tense in regard to the impact Christ makes. They shall be constituted righteous. And that throws the whole issue forward so that it's possible to be constituted a sinner by being part of Adam's offspring, but then being part of Christ's new work and the impact he makes might be understood to just be something that we're going to have to wait until we get there to get. It's going to happen, but it hadn't happened yet. And if that's the case, we might be misled into thinking, well, then our behavior here in time really doesn't matter because there's anything we can do about it anyway. We're constituted sinners by Adam's sin, so we're going to sin unless Christ does something now in the present rather than in the future, then there's really no hope, so we'll just have to sin and let grace abound. That might be a reason why somebody would be misled. Then secondly, we saw in verse 21 that death reigned, sin reigned in death, and therefore, he says, even so, grace might reign through righteousness to life. So again, you have this difference between what happens with Adam. Sin reigns. It rules like a king. And death is the impact. So if grace is going to reign, then it's going to have to bring about eternal life through righteousness. But again, the verb mood is in the subjunctive, which moves it into the area of potential rather than current reality. So if you take the future tense in 519 and then you have the potential mood in 521, you could still kind of stick together with the idea that we're going to persist in sin until sometime in the future when Christ obliterates the roots, and then we'll be righteous altogether and we won't have to worry about it. So that's the second thing. It might cause a person to say, well, yeah, there ain't any point in getting all bent out of shape about continuing in sin because there ain't nothing we can do about it. And then, thirdly, Paul's concept of being in bondage to sin in the first five chapters of Romans is an absolute in Adam's offspring. They can't do anything but sin. That's what bondage to sin means. And so, as long as a person has links to Adam in any way, we're still going to sin because bondage to sin is one of the issues of being linked to Adam. So what would be the point of any real serious effort to not live in the sin? And then finally, Paul declared that grace superabounds when sin abounds, and that tends to make sinning of little or no consequence. I mean, so if you sin, grace will take care of that and more abundantly, and so will just admit they're slacking the gears and expect the grace of God to take up the slack. All four of those are possible reasons why somebody might say, well, what shall we conclude? Shall we persist in the sin and just make that an issue where grace is going to superabound? But Paul's intense denial in verse 2, meganoita, it's translated God forbid in King James because that's about as strong a term in 1611 English that you could use to emphatically deny. The text in the New American Standard, may it never be, is actually a literal translation. Meganoita is an optative, may it never be. And that's an intense denial that our doctrine means that we should persist in the sin. Let grace be the increasing issue there and don't worry about it. But since Paul denies that any of those four things that we talked about in chapter 5 should lead to this, his denial is something that makes it necessary for us to look into how should those issues then influence our thinking. All of us are fully aware that our conversion didn't make us perfect. And we're fully aware that no matter how much improvement might be accomplished by the Spirit of God over our hearts and minds in time, there is always more to be done than has been done. Even the Apostle Paul said, I haven't arrived. I don't consider myself as having arrived. And the old recognition that Paul's own personal growth in understanding holiness, he started early as the least of the apostles, which is a fairly humble evaluation. And he went from there to less than the least of all saints, which is even more humble. And then he became the chief of sinners, which is the most humble position of all. But those comments came up in letters over the progress of his own spiritual growth in life. In the letter to Timothy is where he says he's the chief of sinners. So it's my impression that the longer you grow, the more you grow, the more you see how much more you need to grow. In other words, your confidence that you're everything you ought to be just keeps going the longer you become more and more what you ought to be. It's just a matter of recognition that holiness is so far above anything that can be achieved in a world that has been afflicted by sin that even, I mean, you know, John, the author of the book of the Revelation, he was the guy that was at the cross. He was the dedicated apostle. But when he saw Jesus in his glory, he fell out in a dead faint from fear. And Daniel said all his comeliness had turned to garbage when he saw that holiness. So apparently, the reality is, we all understand that our conversion doesn't effectively address our interactions with sin to any degree of perfection, or even close to it. Given that, how does Paul really want us to act, and what does he want us to believe? Well, according to verse 2, opening statement, he does not want us to take the attitude that sin's not a big deal. Because that's what you'll conclude in chapter 6, verse 1, if you conclude that. And remember, the conclusion we're talking about is a doctrinal conclusion. We're actually deciding how this information is going to affect the way we make our choices and take action. So, he says in verse 2, how shall we who died to sin still live in it? And he raises the question that is, I think, most problematical in the whole context. Because the terminology is misleading if you don't understand what he's saying. Because typically, if you're dead, you can't do anything. That's the typical understanding of being dead. So if you're dead to sin, that should automatically mean you can't sin. But that's obviously not what he means, because in chapter 7 he says, he sins all the time. The good I want to do, I don't do. The bad I don't want to do, I do. And this is as a believer, as an apostle. And, of course, we studied in Galatians how Peter dropped the ball in such a horrific way when he went up to Antioch. So it's clearly possible to sin. So what does it mean? How shall we who died to sin still live in it? What does that really mean? So that's where we're headed. The question that we're going to deal with this evening is this question. What does Paul mean by being dead in respect to sin? His basic claim is that we are dead to sin. Literally, he says dead to the sin. And there he's actually talking about his concept in chapter 5 of the sin, which produces sins. In other words, there is the sin, and Adam passed on the sin, and the consequence of that residing in all his offspring was that they did many sins. And even in verse 1, he says, shall we continue in the sin? But he's already admitted that they aren't continuing in that simply because you get out of the sin by becoming in Christ. You get out of Adam into Christ. So you should be out of the sin thing and into the righteousness of Christ in some form or fashion. So when he says we who died to the sin, how can we continue to persist to live in it, continue to live in it? The words are difficult because of the misleading conception. So that's where we're puzzled. I can remember with tears asking God one time, how can you say I'm dead to sin? I just got through. So, what we want to do is we want to work our way through this. Paul's claim is it's irrational to live in something you died to. But what did you die to and how is it irrational? Well, he starts off by using the phrase, the sin. And that strongly implies for Paul that the sin is the root. And then continuing in sin or still living in sins would be the fruit. If we're still persisting in the sin, then obviously we're going to be doing sins. But his question is, if you have died to the sin, then how can you keep on producing sins? That's the idea in verse 2, and he's started off with this absolute denial that we should conclude that we should just persist in the sin and let grace take up the slack. So, Paul has this concept of the root, the sin, and it strongly implies for Paul that believers are to be focused not on sins, but on the sin. In other words, our focus of attention shouldn't be on our daily dropping the ball issues of sinning. It should be focused on what we have been delivered from in terms of the sin. And his statement in chapter 5, verse 12 is that the sin entered the world through one man. And so death passed through sin to all men, because all sinned. So his statement is that the sin entered into the world by Adam's disobedience. And then in verse 21, he says that the sin ruled as a king. It reigned unto death. So that's the issue then in the second part of verse 1 of chapter 6, if we should persist in the sin, because he's talking about living in it or living it out in chapter 6, verse 2. And therefore, we have to understand that clearly, Paul's concept of death does not mean a cessation of capacity. You can't. You can't cease to have this capacity and then still do it. His questions make no sense if that's what he meant. And therefore, he didn't mean that. Because what he's saying does have to make sense. So, our view of death, where we consider death the inability to function, and that is a legitimate concept of some forms of death, we have to suspend that idea here because that clearly cannot be his meaning. You can't even ask the question, how shall you persist in sin if you have died to it? Because if you really died to it and you lost your capacity to do it, the question doesn't even make sense. Because you couldn't, even if you wanted to. So, we have to understand that Paul's idea of dying to sin doesn't mean that you've lost the capacity to sin, because that whole notion would be self-destructive. If you can't sin, there's no point in raising the question whether we should. You can't. So, the main focus of our thinking has to be at some point the pursuit of what Paul means when he writes about being dead and death. And so when he talks about his concept of death in respect to sin, as well as living out the impact of it, that's where we're going to be focusing our attention. And with this preoccupation, we have to understand something about the identity of the sin. We'll get to the death to it in a minute, or in a few minutes, but we have to understand what he means by this sin, that in the sin that entered in chapter 5, verse 12. The sin entered into the world. What was that? Death passed upon all of Adam's offspring because, according to verse 12, all sinned. So the sin entered when Adam sinned, and the rationale of all sinned with Adam is the rationale that's theologically called the federal headship of Adam over the human race, but it's illustrated in Hebrews by saying that Levi paid tithes to Melchizedek, because Levi was the son of Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, who was the son of Abraham, and Abraham's the guy that met Melchizedek. So we have a son and a grandson and a great-grandson, if I've got it down far enough now. We've got a grandson who wasn't even on the scene paying tithes to Melchizedek. And the book of Hebrews says the rationale for that is Levi was in the loins of Abraham when Abraham did it. So if a man does something, all of his offspring after him, because they come out of his own production, his own seed, they're locked into what he did. He did it, they get credit for having done it too. And that works a couple of different ways in the scriptures. But in Hebrews, the issue is Levi gets credit for paying tithes to Melchizedek. In Romans 5, every person who is an offspring of Adam gets credit for sinning in the garden, even though they weren't there. Except they were in the loins of Adam. And what that means is we have to see the human race as an integrated unit with a federal head who, because all of his offspring came from him, everybody did what he did. That's the rationale for it. So, that's one of the issues that we have to understand when we talk about Adam bringing the sin into this world. Because there were some things in Genesis 3 that probably are issues of sin already in place before the sin. Because you can't do the sin. What was the sin in Genesis 3? What was it that actually brought about condemnation? It was it was the action. Adam bit into the fruit, chewed it, and swallowed it. God had said, don't do that, or you will die. Anything that led up to that, you might consider it sin from our perspective now looking back, but it was not the sin until he bit into that thing, chewed it up, swallowed it. For example, why would he do that? He had been told not to. Well, there are a couple reasons why he would do that. One of them is he didn't love God enough to obey him. Well, isn't lovelessness sin? Well, sure it is. If you don't love God more than anything else, you've already fallen short. So when Adam chose to disobey God, he was proving a lack of love for God, particularly a lack of primary love for God. And that would have been, from our perspective, sinful. But it wasn't the sin, because that's not what brought about the condemnation. It led to it. And not only the lovelessness, but also the faithlessness. The serpent said, you won't die. God said, yeah, you will. And Adam had to decide who he's going to believe. And faithlessness is always a sin. But that wasn't the sin. It led to it. But those two things could have all been blown off In fact, they could have been corrected. If when Adam got a hold of that fruit and went, he said, oh, wait a minute. Put it back. Because then love would have returned, faith would have returned, and he would have never committed the sin. So in the garden, the issue of the sin consisted of, I think, three things. The first one is that it's the act of eating that was the sin. And the act of eating did something to the physical body of Adam so that it made it possible for all of the seed that was in Adam when he ate to be corrupted. In other words, I've always likened it to some kind of a DNA or genetic poison. When he ate it, it poisoned his system in such a way that all of his offspring are now flawed at the physical level with this genetic poison that has created now a strong propensity for sinning. And we all are aware of how that can work, because God had said, if you eat it, you'll die. And the dying part at the physical body level took over 900 years for that degenerative cycle that was introduced by that poison in the system to kill him. Took over 900 years. Doesn't take that long now. But the point is, the seed was actually physically corrupted into a physical, cyclical disintegration of the body until it finally returns to its basic essential makeup, dust. So it's dust to dust. And that fruit, when he ate it, created a downward cyclical spiral, turning the body back into the dust from which it came, even though it took 900 years for it to happen. So, that's the first thing we have to understand. The act was, the introduction of the sin was, a corruption of the physical makeup of humankind. So that now they're genetically corrupted. And that means then that we also have to understand the second thing. And that is that the act of the sin put man's physical existence into a kind of jeopardy that would always afterwards pressure man to make his physical life the major focus of his attention. It's called the survival instinct. You don't have to have a survival instinct until you first have a problem with surviving. You have to have a reason why you're not going to survive in order to, for a survival instinct to develop or kick in. If when Adam ate that fruit, it sent his body into this general, inevitable, final disintegration, then his survival instinct is going to kick in. And according to Hebrews 2:15, all men are subject to the bondage of fear of death all their lifetime. Hebrews 2:15 says men are in bondage to fear because of death all of their lifetime, which means that the survival instinct is in gear. And this was created by the beginning of the disintegration of the physical man. So that is a loveless reality. It's a faithless reality, but it is a reality. The body wants to survive. And even if you're not consciously trying to survive, your body will. You will consciously hold your breath if somebody throws you in the water. You won't do it deliberately. You'll just do it. If you get thrown into the water and you can swim, you will automatically start swimming. If you can't swim, you'll automatically start splashing big time. It's the survival instinct. And another thing that will come with it is a terror. That's where all our phobias come from, is these terrors. So, apparently, when Adam ate the fruit, it created a flaw in his physical makeup that drove his physical body to engage in self-preservation mechanisms, survival. And I think Hebrews 2:15 is a clear statement that that did happen. Because from Genesis 3, all men have been held in bondage all their lifetime through the fear of death. And then thirdly, I think Paul's the sin concept is that being sponsored by the serpent it actually opened the door of man's existence to the dominion of an evil spirit inside of his body. Ephesians 2:2 says that we were dead in our trespasses and sins, and we walked according to the spirit of the power of the air, the spirit that now is working in the sons of disobedience. So every disobedient son, every offspring of Adam, apparently has a spiritual presence within his body that's not his own. I often wondered, how did Adam pass on the sin in such a way that we could actually argue that the virgin birth was a way of getting around that, because the woman doesn't pass it on, the man does. But a genetic flaw doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to just do sins. If the genetic flaw does necessarily mean that you're going to have this survival instinct kick in, sometime you will sin, because your survival instinct will cause you to put the right thing down and do the wrong thing just to survive. So I can see where a genetic problem might cause some sins, but I can't see it just dominating them. But apparently, Ephesians 2:2, Paul recognizes that there is a very real spirit influence within man's body that addresses, apparently, that man's own spirit and soul and body in such a way that now he is in bondage to sin, and that spirit, that evil spirit in him that works in the sons of disobedience, is now making it impossible for him to do righteousness. He is doing sin all the time. Because now you've got two issues. You've got the body that does the actual overt behavior, and you've got a spirit inside there motivating and activating that body to do that. That's where all the scriptures emphasize. The actions of the body are driven by some kind of spiritual power from within. Therefore, Adam's act allowed Satan to superimpose himself, and apparently his followers impose that spirit of disobedience upon the spirit of man, so that Satan could be and is the dominant spiritual force in man's living and choices. That's why the offspring of Adam do nothing but sin. There is a spirit that is directing that. And Ephesians 2:2 says that it's connected to Satan, the prince of power of the air. So now we have a spirit and a body that answers the question, okay, how was the sin passed on? Well, Adam opened the door by eating. That corrupted his flesh. And by his willingness to believe Satan's lie, he opened the door for Satan to actually become a dominant presence in his own experience. And I think that there is a parallel to that in 2 Corinthians 2. Paul had told the Corinthians in the first letter to cast a man out of their congregation who was living with his father's wife. And in chapter 2, he comes back to that thesis, and he says in verse 5, if any has caused sorrow, he has caused sorrow not to me, but in some degree, in order not to say too much, to all of you. And then he says in verse 6, sufficient for such a one is this punishment which was inflicted by the majority. Remember, he told them, next time you come together, you kick him out. Deliver him over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh. Well, apparently when they started to do that, he repented. So in verse 7 it says, on the contrary, you should rather forgive and comfort him, lest somehow such a one be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow, being delivered over to Satan and all the things that are involved in that. Wherefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love for him, for to this end I wrote to you, that I might put you to the test, whether you're obedient in all things. But whom you forgive, I forgive. Indeed, what I have forgiven, if I've forgiven anything, I did it for your sakes in the presence of Christ, in order that no advantage may be taken of us by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes. So what he's actually saying is, Satan can actually establish a kind of a beachhead of advantage in people who mishandle sin. And that's exactly what Adam did. He opened the beachhead. And according to Ephesians 2, the opening of that beachhead meant that now there is a spirit that works in all of the sons of disobedience and produces disobedience. So now we have both a physical and a spiritual way for the sin to be in every offspring of Adam so that now they are dominated by it. The genetic reality, the self-focus of survival instinct, and an evil spirit in dominion. That makes sin just go to every offspring of Adam. Therefore, we can say this, the sin is identified as permission for Satan to invade the bodies of men weakened by the fear of physical death so that they are now constituted sinners. Permission for Satan to invade the bodies of men weakened by the fear of physical death so that now they are constituted sinners. They can't escape. They have the fear of death. They have a dominion of an evil spirit motivating their behavior of sinful things, and that just increases their fear. Every guilty feeling increases the fear of death because guilt means I'm going to get it. I'm going to get whacked. And so every time somebody does something and feels guilty, they feel like they're under condemnation. So that's a pretty hopeless kind of scenario for those that are in Adam. And that's what Paul says we died to. We died to the sin. Now, understanding that, then, we have to understand that the main question of our preoccupation with death to sin is this. What does it mean to die to the sin? And the only basis for understanding death is our experience of it in the physical realm, coupled to the Word of God. In other words, death starts to mean something to us because we've witnessed death at the physical body level. And our witness of the physical body level thing lays a foundation then for understanding anything above that physical realm. It's kind of like Jesus using physical birth as a metaphor for what happens to you when you're regenerated. You have to be born again. But obviously being born again doesn't mean physical. Nicodemus went right straight to that, and Jesus said, no. Can't believe you're a master of Israel and you don't understand this. But what Nicodemus didn't realize is that God has created a physical universe so that we have these physical realities in order to inform our understanding of the same kinds of things in a non-physical reality. So we have a lot of metaphor. We live our lives learning from the physical realm and then applying it to the metaphor of a non-physical reality. Oh, this is kind of like this. Yeah, this happens here and that happens there. And man, there's so many similarities. So this is the metaphor that comes off of this reality. And you know, they've even studied children in their development. They actually go through a period in their early thinking where they can only think literally. They cannot apply the physical. They can't move it to the non-physical. Was it you or Brett? I think it was Brett. One time when he was just a little kid, he was crying about something. And I just told him, said, son, if you make your bed hard, you have to sleep in it. Well, that evening, he came to his mom crying. She said, what's the matter? He said, I don't want to sleep in a hard bed. He couldn't understand the metaphor, simply because in his mind, if I said he had to sleep in a hard bed, he was going to be laying on a board. And he didn't want to lay on a board. It was upsetting to him. Well, that's just the way human mental capacity develops. And so there's a time when you really cannot communicate beyond the material. Everything is going to be concrete in the minds of the kid. So we have to ask this question, what does it mean to die to the sin? And how do we use physical death as the primary base for our understanding? And Paul says in verse 3, that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus have been baptized into his death. So our link is going to be something relating to, and we'll get back to this at a later time, but the issue of being baptized into Christ and being baptized into his death. But nonetheless, the main thing there is that since our death to the sin is tied to the death of Jesus Christ, we'll start by looking into his death to see what death meant in his case. And then maybe we can move from what it meant in his case to what it means in ours as we work our way through chapters 6, 7, and 8. So the most obvious sense of death in relation to Jesus was what happened to him on the cross when he said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And then he exhaled his spirit and his body collapsed in death. His head dropped and his arms held up his body. He was dead physically. His body died. And what we actually understand from that is that the most obvious sense of death at the physical level is the departure of the spirit within the body from the body, so that what is the result is called being dead. James 2:6. Without the spirit, the body is dead. Well, at the physical level, what that means is that there is a body, which the scriptures identify as an instrument of manifestation. And then there is a spirit that is breathed into that body to energize all of its activity. If the spirit that's in there is energizing all of its activity, if the spirit leaves there, then what's going to happen? The body is going to become inactive. And that's where we get into problems with our being dead to the sin, because at the physical level, that's exactly what it means. The body can't function anymore. The spirit is departed from it and it's gone. So, in light of the physical death then, the most obvious sense is that there is a real issue called what I call significant distance separation. The spirit is the life root for the function of the body, and the body is the object of the spirit in terms of its energizing. It energizes the body. So the spirit makes my fingers go out like that when I'm doing that, makes my tongue work, makes my lungs push the air through my larynx. There's a spirit inside doing all that. You take the spirit out, and none of that can happen. But there is also this reality about the physical body and the spirit that's dwelling in it, and that is the difference between a weakening of the connections between the spirit and the body, so that weakness, illness, irreversible disintegration, gradual descent into physical death is different from the total disconnect of the spirit that brings about final death. It's a quasi-distance issue. In other words, if the spirit is capable of energizing the body without restriction, then the spirit can energize all of the parts of the body equally well, no problems. But we know from physical science that there are some things the inner spirit cannot overcome in terms of physical body issues. You put a gun to your head and pull the trigger, and if it doesn't kill you, it will destroy a bunch of brain cells, and the cells that are destroyed, the spirit that's dwelling in that body will not be able to overcome the destruction of those cells. So now the body can't do some things that it used to be able to do. The spirit was able to make it do it because it had access to these capacities that were built into this physical structure, and the structure's been destroyed. A more graphic illustration, perhaps, is if something happens and you get your arm cut off. Well, then all of a sudden your spirit doesn't have an arm to work with there anymore. And there are certain things it can't do. And we also know this concept of the immune system, where as long as your body has the capacities built into it, then the spirit has the ability to use those capacities to self-regenerate the body to make it healthy again. So you get sick and the spirit within you utilizes certain capacities the body has built into it and you get well. But that capacity breaks down because of what? That genetic poison that has corrupted the mechanism of the body so that now the body isn't able to function at 100% all the time, if it ever was. And so as the body is being gradually turned back into the dust reality, as it disintegrates slowly, the spirit that's within the body is incapable of vitalizing the body at the same level all the time. I just call that the weakening of the link. If the link is actually totally disconnected, the spirit is gone from the body, then it's not a weakening, it's a total disconnect. And once the total disconnect actually occurs, and the spirit and the body are separated from one another, then physical death has occurred. That's physical. And a consequent inability of the body to benefit from the union of the spirit and the body is an automatic result, because as long as the spirit's in the body, the abilities of the spirit to energize the functions of the body, it just naturally flows from the spirit to the body, from the spirit to the body, from the spirit to the body. And then the body just naturally does into the world the things that it does, because the spirit is energizing the functions of the body in certain ways and influences, and so the body is acting and it's manifesting the inner spirit, because the spirit is energizing all of those different things. So if the spirit leaves, then the body has no ability to do that anymore. And that means that the body will gradually return to dust. And that return means that part of the meaning of death is the cessation of that which is dead to function and maintain its living organizational character. The body, as it is right now, is not dust, but its essence is dust. The dust is organized and given certain capacities by its organizational structure, and when a person's spirit leaves, that body does not instantaneously turn back to dust. It's a gradual disintegration. It may not take a long time, depending on how many helpers it has, but nonetheless, from dust to dust over a period of time as the body disintegrates. And that's a part of our understanding of death. It's an inability to maintain the functional organizational character so that now you can't function and you can't maintain your functional structure. So you do not want to be subjected to the loss of oxygen for too long, or you'll have severe irreversible brain damage, and the spirit that's in your body will not be able to overcome that. It's just the way it is. So that means then that the body can't benefit from the spirit because the spirit's departed, and the spirit ceases to have any ability to express itself in the physical world because the body was its instrument of activity in the physical world and it's left the body. And so this is the first element of the death of the Christ at the physical body level. His body began to rapidly disintegrate to the point, if he hadn't been resurrected, it would have disintegrated to the point of dust to dust. His spirit would have no longer had any ability to manifest itself in the physical world, and it didn't get that ability. The little spirit came back into it. That's what's called resurrection. So the body lost its capacity, and the spirit lost its capacity. The body can't function, and the spirit can't manifest itself. Both of them have lost out because they're now separated. That's our primary metaphor for understanding what it means to be dead. It's the primary physical reality that establishes a metaphor for all of our understanding of death beyond that. Okay?